like, what sort of relaxation activities were they provided by the military, or did you have to find them on your own?
Both. Military, we were on the Gulf of Siam, so the water was right there, and they had sailboats. You could go rent sailboats and go sailing. They had the instructors to teach you how to do that. You could go scuba diving. They had equipment for that. Of course, you had to take classes if you wanted to do that. There was a skydiving club. You could do that. There was the NCO club, the USO, and they had, you know, ping pong tables, pool tables, and whatnot. There was always tours going out of the USO if you wanted to go on an organized tour. Of course, with there again, the good thing about being friends with guys who were into the Thai culture is that a lot of times we just get a taxi cab or what they call a bot bus, which is pretty much like an S10 Chevy pickup. They just put a top on the back of it, and they call it a bot bus. And they call it that because a baht is a form of money in Thailand that is equivalent roughly to a nickel. And usually for a nickel or a baht, you could ride about anywhere you wanted to. So a lot of times we'd go out and take the guy $5, he'd take us across the country if we wanted to. And we just kind of rent the baht bus for the afternoon. We just go up in the mountains or go down to a different beach, sea coast or whatever. So we got out on our own a lot and saw things. A few times we rented motorcycles and rode up into places of the country that, you know, we had never seen before. And Americans were pretty unique when you got up into some of these little rural areas where a lot of these folks had never seen Americans. I mean, you really cause quite a stir sometimes when you go riding there on a motorcycle. We never feared, you know, for our lives, you know, as far as safety was concerned because of, you know, the war, what was going on. Of course, we were young. We didn't think a whole lot about it. And looking back on it now, I probably wouldn't have done some of the things I did, wouldn't have gone to some of the places I did. We actually went into Laos one time. Went up to, there's a river, the Mekong River, separates Thailand from Laos. And I had some friends that were stationed at Uthaladit. No, it wasn't. It was Udorn was the base up in the northern part of Thailand. And we went up to visit them, and they said, come on, let's go up to the Mekong River. So we got in a taxi cab, rode up there, and there's this majestic river flowing, and they were saying, right across there is Laos. That's it, right over there. So we were talking to a couple of vendors there at the river crossing and asking if we could go across. They said, oh, no, you have a passport and special permission and all that. And this little old man approached us when we walked outside and said, hey, you want to go across? And we said, yeah, can we? He said, yeah, $10, I'll take you. So we went down the street a little ways and went down this little dock. There was a boat, and it was the weirdest motor on this boat. It was like a V8 engine you'd find in a car. It had a straight rod going right behind it, and on the back of it was a propeller. And this whole thing was mounted on some sort of contraption on the back of the boat. He fired that thing up just like a GTO cranking up, and it was on a swivel, so you could swivel, balance the motor up, and like the prop would come out of the water. Or you'd like raise it up and the prop would go down in the water. And so we hopped in this little boat and he fired that thing up and we took off and went to Laos and right across the river. And we got over there and there was some sort of a garden, and it was like all these different Buddhas. There was like a reclining Buddha and a standing Buddha and a sleeping Buddha and a weeping Buddha and a laughing Buddha and all these different statues and all. We thought they were incredible. I took a lot of pictures while there. And we just kind of walked all through that garden place. And then we started walking down the road. And the guy that was our guide, the guy that rode the boat, I mean, he was about as timid about the whole thing as we were. We were just kind of leading the way. And we got up to the side of the road, and we saw this Jeep coming. And suddenly this guy spoke up and says, we go now. So I guess maybe that was the Laotians or something he saw coming. And so we didn't mess around very much. We went now. And went back, got in the boat, and took off and headed back to Thailand. But that's about the closest, I guess, we ever got to, you know, action in our kind of work anyway.
So I would say, how did public opinion in the U.S. influence your work there in Vietnam?
I don't think it influenced my work at all. Like I said, we were just doing a top 40 radio station. You know, we were pretty much insulated from, you know, what we're hearing from the States. We didn't hear a whole lot from the States because, as I said, everything was censored. In those days, in the early 70s, the satellite technology was not what it is today, so we didn't have live TV news updates and our local news, we get news clips that were like a week old from the States. And, of course, we only got the ones they handpicked they wanted people to see. Now, we had live radio news reports, but, again, that was AFRTS news. They didn't let, you know, private commercial news organizations run news. So, about the only news you got is if you called home and talked to your family or whatever, or, you know, if you got a copy of a newspaper, a lot of us got papers over there, and heard what was going on. Of course, the anti-war sentiment was very big. There were some people on the base that, you know, expressed that as well. To my recollection, the biggest thing, the biggest issue that bothered us throughout the time I was there was racism. It was really rampant at the time. The black population of the race kind of on the base stayed to themselves. The white guys sort of stayed to themselves. And we had white and black both that worked in the radio station, and most of us got along pretty well. But still, the black guys kind of had their own little thing. And any time they would meet on the base, they would do this little hand jive thing, you know. And they kind of had their own little way of greeting, and, you know, they'd stand in the door at the base exchange and do that little hand jive thing and hold up, you know, other guys trying to get in. A lot of times it caused bad situations. I remember one time, the way we had the radio station formatted, and this had nothing to do with the way it was perceived, but we had various hours. There was a country hour and a rock hour and an easy listening hour and a, you know, oldie hour, different hours throughout the day. As it turned out, country music was on between 5 and 6 in the morning. It was on between 11 and 12 in the morning. And it was on between 4 and 5 in the afternoon. Well, it was followed immediately by a different type of programming. Well, the black population on the base complained that every time they went to the chow hall, all they heard was country music. And they made a big issue of it and circulated a petition and called it racist and all. Well, the radio station, the management there, was told by the base commander and the information office to change that, to change things around because they wanted to keep the black people happy. Well, some of us at the station thought that was ridiculous because it was not done just in spite of them. That's just the way it was. And most people aren't eating between 5 and 6 in the morning, 11 to 12 in the afternoon, or 4 to 5 in the afternoon anyway. So we sort of rebelled about that. And one of my buddies, Barry Callis, who now lives in Richmond, Virginia, went on the air one morning early, and I was there with him at the time, and he did an editorial, an unsolicited editorial, about that very policy, about how a few people on the base can complain and get the whole radio station changed. Well, he had no sooner got started with that little editorial than I got a call, and I was the only other person at the radio station. I picked up the phone, and it was the base commander's office. Said he was sending a car over. He wanted Specialist Callis to be in his office in 10 minutes. And so luckily I was there, so I took over and played records while Barry went over and was completely chewed out and almost shot for what he did. And he told me the word to the base commander was, "We're sitting on a powder keg here. And you were over there striking matches." I think they got Barry's attention. But anyway, this is kind of out of the way of the question. But public opinion in the States was about the Vietnam War. Over there, even though we were a big piece of the machinery that was playing in the war, the biggest concern we had was racism on the base. That was our biggest problem.
Were you stationed in Vietnam during the Tet Offensive during that time?
Yeah. That was probably the busiest I'd ever seen that base. And I used the analogy many times that the base was like, the whole base was like a gigantic gun. And all the things that happened on the base, including the radio station, the chow hall, the USO, every little piece of activity was like part of the mechanism that resulted in the pulling of the trigger, that resulted in the bomb being dropped. And I mean, that was the mission of the base, was to drop the bombs. And everything on the base supported that end result. It got busy. I can remember three B-52s taking off. They take off in sorties of three at a time. As three would leave, three would come in. This went on 24 hours a day during Tet, just as fast as they could roll a guys who worked in a munitions maintenance squadron whose job it was to load the bombs. They were on 24-hour shifts. I mean, they were working like 12 hours on, 12 hours off. It was a busy time. The field maintenance squadrons who had to maintain the planes, I mean, they were telling me how a lot of things that needed attention they had to let go because the first order of business was to get it back in the air. One of the real harsh memories that I have of that time is there was a daily bulletin that came out every day on the base. It was sort of like a newspaper, but it was just like written on like legal-sized paper stapled together, usually two or three pages long. And on that paper, they would list all the things. I guess every base does this, but it would list all the activities going on that day on the base, all the things that were happening, things people need to know about, when the NCO club was having their next trip. I mean, all the information for that day. The last segment of the page said, anyone having claims against the estate of, please contact the following. And usually that, during TET particularly, that would get to be sometimes as many as three or four pages long. And what that was people who were sitting beside us the day before in the NCO club having coffee, and today they're in the jungle of Vietnam because they were shot down. And they were coming off that very base. And I used to walk in the NCO club or the USO and just look around and see the guys in the flyers. And of course they had their jumpsuits and all the way to work, thinking, you know, I wonder if that guy will be here tomorrow. Because a lot of times they'd go off on a mission, and the next day you'd see their name there on the daily bulletin. So that was, you know, a real harsh reality of what was actually going on there. Can you explain to me a little bit how were things after the TET offensive? Did anything change that influenced any type of new ideas or anything? Well, during the TET offensive, everybody was busy. I mean, the whole base was at a fever pitch all the time. They didn't have time to nitpick and worry about little insignificant seeming things to us, like if your shoes were shined or if your hair was cut, that sort of thing. As soon as the TET offensive was over, we used to, you know, refer to it as, you know, Mickey Mouse came marching in, because, I mean, suddenly all those old silly things you hate about the military started appearing again. Suddenly they had time to worry about your mustache being a little bit too long, or your hair not being trimmed, or your shoes not being shined. I mean, all the little nitpicky things suddenly then became big issues, and everywhere you went, people were screwing with you. Again, I was pretty much insulated from that because I was in the Army, and they didn't quite know what the regulations were. They were different. For instance, in the Air Force, your mustache had to end at the crack of your mouth. Well, in the Army, your mustache could extend beyond the crack of your mouth and come down like a Ho Chi Minh type thing, and it could actually come down, you know. Later, they changed that rule. It could be long, but it couldn't come past the crack of your mouth, but it could go out parallel to your lip. So some guys, like, twirled them, you know, on the ends and had long mustaches like that. But in the Air Force, you couldn't do that. Army, you could. And there's a few little stupid regulations like that we tried to explore and do all we could because we wanted to get by with as much as we could. It was kind of, you know, our goal. The real fun thing was when I would take the Air Force Jeep in my Army uniform and drive over to the post office. And you'd see people walking along and looking at them, my goodness, what is that? You know, it's an Army guy driving an Air Force Jeep. Must be a runaway. There also, we had some secretive aircraft, the U-2, when it was flying. I'll never forget when it landed at Utapau, the information office actually called the radio station and told us to make an announcement for no one to be looking at the flight line between the hours of 1400 and 1600. Well, I mean, it was the stupidest thing in the world because everybody in the world was down there looking at to see what was going on. But their reasoning was that they didn't want people to... Their reasoning was that they just didn't want people to see that new highly secretive aircraft that was coming in. So a lot of things that they did in the military didn't make any sense at all. Our radio station was there for the purpose of entertaining the troops, trying to take away some of the anguish and grief and the loneliness, being away from home, that sort of stuff. Towards the end, after the TET offensive and close to the end of my return to the States, suddenly it got to where there was nothing important going on. Everything was Mickey Mouse. The guys that were running the radio station back when I first got there and back during the Tet Offensive during that period of time, everything was business. I mean, what I mean by that is everybody was busy all the time. It wasn't so serious. I mean, there was a little bit of levity in about everything that, that took place. Suddenly, you had guys in there who had cross-trained from a life in the military as a security guard.